Hello, everybody. Today's episode is brought to you by The Great Courses Plus. It's an online streaming service. Have you heard of this? It's pretty cool. It allows you to expand your knowledge on a huge variety of topics. It's convenient. You can watch or listen wherever you go, whenever you want. You can learn about virtually anything from Shakespeare to medieval Europe to the mysteries of human behavior, photography, you name it. There's unlimited access at The Great Courses Plus to thousands of lectures presented by experts who are not only knowledgeable, but passionate about their subjects. The Great Courses Plus has a fantastic course that I recommend starting with. It's called Life Lessons from the Great Books. It offers entree into the world of masterpieces from Macbeth to Brave New World to the Odyssey and more, exploring wisdom that can be gleaned from each story and the different ways that it can be applied to any culture or stage of life. The Great Courses Plus is an enriching addition to any human life. So here's a special offer for you. Are you ready? An entire month of learning, unlimited learning for free. Enjoy life lessons from the great books and so much more by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/otherppl. Start your free month trial right now. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/otherppl. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/otherppl. Okay.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Jesus, dude, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible. You know, it was like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listing.
Just one time.
How's it going? Welcome to the Other People podcast. I'm Brad Listing. I'm in Los Angeles, California. I'm sitting here. I'm very pleased to have Tommy Pico on the program today. He is a poet. He is a gifted performer of his own work. He's a screenwriter. He has a podcast called Food for Thought. He curates a reading series with Morgan Parker called Poets with Attitude. Does a lot of different things. We talk about all of it. Tommy Pico in just a moment. His poetry books include IRL, which is out from Birds LLC. That won the 2017 Brooklyn Library Literary Prize. And then his other books include Nature Poem, Junk, and the forthcoming Feed. All of those from Tin House Books. He is a recipient of a Whiting Award. Did I mention that? He's been profiled in Time Out New York, the New York Times, the New Yorker. And he's sort of bi-coastal. He lives in Brooklyn sometimes. He lives here in Los Angeles. He was kind enough to come over and talk with me. And you're going to hear that conversation right now. Here he is, folks. This is Tommy Pico.
I'm kind of on a perpetual book tour, to be honest with you, which is a great life to have because it means that I can afford to just, like, stay at home and write for the rest of the time. But it means traveling a whole lot. And being based in New York, it's a lot easier to get around other places in, like, sort of the Northeast, in the Northeast in general, and not have to, like, drive because, like, the train and the bus system is so extensive. Whereas, like, living out here, I have to do a lot more, like, plane travel and stuff like that.
So what do you mean by like a perpetual book tour?
My books have, fortunately, they're being taught a lot at universities. And so every fall, every spring semester, I am out on the road to, you know, St. Louis, to Chicago, to Tampa, to all these schools. And I kind of just live out of a suitcase a lot of the time.
And they invite you.
Yeah. You get paid. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. I mean, it subsidizes my life as a writer, but it means that I heard this quote. I think it was from Sarah Paulson, and maybe she was talking about somebody else, but she was like, I don't get paid to act. I would do the acting for free, but I get paid because I miss birthday parties. I miss, you know, weddings. I miss best friend birthday, like stuff like that. And I feel the same way. Like, I would perform for free, but it's like I miss a lot. And you know, I don't have like a romantic life. It's hard to get traction with anybody when you're on the road all the time. And it's kind of like the theme or like the subject of my fourth book, the one that's coming out in the fall, which is
called what?
Feed.
Okay.
Out from Tin House, fall 2019. And it's a lot of it is about being a traveling performer and perpetually traveling and the excitement of that, but then also the loneliness of it.
There's like that adrenaline rush. You do the performance and then you're back in some weird hotel, right?
Yeah. And I'm just kind of like sitting there in a bathrobe sometimes with a glass of vino verde, feeling a little bit like, oh, I've made it. And also feeling like, I wish my friends were here. I mean, I talk to like a lot of my friends are stand-ups and they have very similar relationships because, you know, their life is also a lot of times subsidized by universities and comedy clubs, and they'll be in weird comedy condos or in, like, you know, motels or whatever, and that it's so hard to know what to do with the adrenaline afterwards. I understand why people like would just get fucked up or, you know, get drunk or whatever, because the experience of being on stage in front of so many people and interacting with them and like the kind of mental acrobatics and physical acrobatics that you have to do in order to get to that point of being up in front of people. Cause I'm just very naturally shy. But in order to do that and then to enjoy it, and to give the audience a show, then it used to be a lot harder for me to put that performance energy on. And now it's just much harder for me to take it off. Like, I don't know what to do with myself afterwards. Like, I'll get off stage and I'll be like shaking and not be able to talk to anybody. And then I'll like be laying in bed later, like unable to go to sleep. And I'm like, dang, what is going on? There must be an easier way of doing this.
Is it you? Like, that's the thing. Like, cause I feel like I've talked to some writers who in a very like normal way, I feel like normal writerly way, are shy, introverted, but then get these invitations to read or perform and discover that they do have this performative aspect to themselves. And I guess the question is like, part of it's like, well, you're being invited, mm-hmm. and there are people showing up, mm-hmm. and they're expecting some kind of performance.
And they could literally be anywhere else, but they chose to be there with me in that room. So I want to give them something.
So I guess the question then is like, how do you, if your natural inclination is towards shyness and introversion, how do you create a performative self that is authentic? Do you feel it's authentic?
I do. I mean, it's authentic to itself in the sense that when I first started out, I remember like, I would get like, I would shake and I would turn red and I would like sweat profusely. I was unable to just do it as me. Because in a way it's like very exposing. And so if I got on stage and I thought I was doing it as me, Tommy Pico, I don't know that I would be able to go through with it because I would feel like people were seeing me. But if I get up there and my voice goes up a little bit and I'm like, ah, hi, it's Tommy T. Like I call that person Teebs. That's like my alter ego. He's the one that I write my books. The perspective of the books is from him. I mean, and we're very similar in the sense that we inhabit the same body and we exhibit the same characteristics, but his inclination is towards confrontation, right? Whereas mine is a little bit to go inward a little bit more.
So you have like an alter ego?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I was, you know, it's interesting. I've heard you say in other interviews or I've read in other interviews where you like, I kind of have to trick myself into writing poetry. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you're tricking yourself into performing.
Absolutely.
So it's like you create these circumstances or you, what do you tell yourself? You tell yourself that you're Teebs?
In the beginning, I think more so I had to just like pump myself up. It was more of like a ritual or a routine, or I had to like get into like some kind of headspace. Now, I don't know how to explain it other than I am myself until the moment the curtain comes up or whatever, metaphorically, and I could just, in a snap, I feel it like some kind of string from the top of my head just pulls me upward, and all of a sudden, like, I'm him, you know?
And you can do it. And what's, like, what are the key differences? Like, one, I guess Teebs is, like, extroverted.
Yeah, I guess I have a tendency to second guess myself in general. I think probably a lot of people, if not everyone, does. And sometimes that, the inclination to second guess myself leads me to a place of complete and utter static and inaction. Cause I don't know, like, do I dare to eat a peach? You know what I mean? But Teebs is like, he doesn't second guess anything, but also he talks so fast that if he misspeaks, he can like just keep going on from there. So in a way it's like a kind of unfurling of a kind of energy that I kind of keep locked down deep inside of me that I don't let out that often.
Well, and it's like people coming to see a performance don't want to watch somebody be indecisive on stage.
No,
they don't want to watch
no.
somebody like quibble with themselves.
Yeah. Or constantly apologize or whatever. But then, It's weird because a lot of the friends that I have now, through the podcast that I have, Food for Thought, or who I've met since publishing books, they don't necessarily know that is a new, that's an intervention, like a new innovation of my personality. Like I used to, like for the majority of my 20s, I was so shy and like I could not get on stage. And I realized that the difference between selling, you know, 100 books or selling 100,000 books was me getting on stage and selling it. So I had to like kind of do a boot camp with myself. You know, I did a lot of, like, I started going to, a singing teacher, and I would do vocal exercises and just to be able to project. I could not project to the back of a room. I had a mentor named Pamela Sneed. She's a poet and an actress and activist and a bunch of other stuff. And she really taught me a lot of performance basics. And I also took an improv class just because I heard that it was good for like loosening up that static, you know. And then their tagline, it was at UCB, and their tagline was like, think at the top of your intelligence or something like that. And that taught me how to be decisive in the moment. And also just getting on stage as often as I possibly could. I created a reading series so that I could get on stage every other month.
So you really like systematically attacked this.
Mm-hmm.
And you also had like this insight that you're not going to sell books unless you, as a poet, that makes sense. You've got to get up in front of people. I think if people see you in a engaging, possibly funny, entertaining way, mm-hmm. perform the work, they're more likely to connect with it.
Yeah. And I thought that, I mean, I don't think that's the duty of the quote unquote poet, but it became my duty to myself and to potentially for people who would read my work. I mean, I think it's audacious to assume that you're going to have a reader anyway, but if you do have one and they do show up, I do want to give them something. I started a reading series in New York at the Ace Hotel with Morgan Parker called Poets with Attitude. And that was our main goal. It didn't matter what poetic style you had. It didn't matter what you were writing about or how old you were or whatever. It was more so like, do you give something to the crowd? And so we'd have poets come. We had like three every season. They would come to the Ace Hotel and we would just, they had to be people whose performance style we liked. I mean, and it didn't have to be like my style. It didn't have to be like Morgan's style either. I mean, we're more confrontational readers, but it was like if somebody had figured out their voice, you know what I mean? In performance, like those are the people we wanted to bring in and to display and put on stage.
Do you do crowd work?
More so when I'm doing a live show with the podcast, with Food for Thought, that's more interactive crowd-wise. I mean, the point of having a live podcast is so that you interact with the crowd a little bit more, right? But I've learned how to take cues from the crowd, right? A lot of times, though, because when I'm reading, it's from long work. So there's not that break in between poems that like typical poets have. So it's like I'm going to be reading like for a stretch of 20 minutes without a break in between it.
Yeah, because you work long form poetry.
Yeah. Exclusively in the long form. I was so happy when I discovered what my thing was, like when I found my medium, you know, it was kind of like finding your medicine that worked, like some routine or something that works for you. And I was like, that's why I've been so restless and unsuccessful and looked over in all the other types of writing that I tried to do before, because I was trying to fit my voice into a medium instead of bending a medium towards my voice, you know?
Right. How did you find it?
Well, I think, again, it was like a lot of small interventions that accumulated over time. One of them was taking the improv class that led me to Then I took a workshop with Ariana Rhines, and it was called Ancient Evenings. And the idea, it was very much in the spirit of improv, but the idea was like we would read some kind of ancient, impenetrable text. Then we would spend some time just kind of writing to ourselves, quietly listening to music for like 5 minutes. Then we wrote for 10 minutes, and then we shared what we wrote. And it was kind of the experience of having to write something in the moment and then share it terrified me, but it terrified me into writing clearly, and also being adherent to the reading that we did before, even if I didn't totally understand it, I realized that whatever it brought out in me, whatever I read in the text, whatever it brought out in me, I was already thinking those things. You know, that was my interpretation. That's how you build a reading, and then building a reading and understanding what I was thinking, then I was able to synthesize that into writing. So that's why with long form, I knew that I could write every day as long as I fed myself with something, as long as I fed myself with something challenging and paid attention to the thoughts that were louder than others, then I could. So giving myself a daily writing practice via this ancient evenings thing was a part of it.
So your daily writing practice involves first reading?
Mm-hmm. Reading or watching something or, you know, interacting with the world in a meaningful way. So whether that is deep reading a book or taking myself to a film or listening to music, but like not putting it on in order to tune out, but putting it on in order to tune in. Because again, like then I just find myself having random opinions and then I turn that into writing. So that was a part of it. A part of it was kind of deciding to read longer work. I had not done that before, probably the age of 29, because I was afraid of long work. I was afraid of my inability to pay attention to it. I mean, short poems are hard enough.
When you say long work, you mean long poems.
Long poems, yeah. Like book-length poems, primarily. I thought that it was totally beyond my capabilities as a reader and as a human being to pay attention to anything for that long. But once I let loose my inhibition and really interacted with it, I found a new level of appreciation for poems because it was something that lived with me. You know, it grew with me. I took it around in my day and my day became a part of the work and I became a part of the work. And I found that experience so transcendent and unlike anything I'd ever felt before. And then I took a workshop with Jason Koo through his outfit called Brooklyn Poets. And we were reading A.R. Ammons. And our challenge was we were reading a section of Tape for the Turn of the Year, and our challenge was to write something sort of in that style or begin something longer. And again, I took the way I read with Ancient Evenings and sort of the way I performed with Pam and the way that I learned how to be adherent to my thoughts. And I in the space of that 15-minute workshop, I wrote the first three pages of what became IRL, my first book. And then it was Beyoncé's visual album coming out in 2013 on my birthday as I turned 30. Literally the second December 13th hit, it was all over the place. And it was a long poem. And it was a visual poem. And it was also a song of it was like an epic song cycle. And I'm from the Kumeyaay Nation in Southern California. And one of the cornerstones of our traditional music are these things called the bird songs, and they are epic song cycles. And so I started to understand that I was actually participating, not necessarily in long poems, but I was participating in bird songs, in the making of bird songs. My dad is a bird singer. I grew up listening to them. They're embedded inside of me. And so I was able to kind of connect something ancient inside of me with something new in the world. And the synthesis of those things became my books.
That makes perfect sense. Like there's like a flawless logic to that. It's almost one of those things where you look in hindsight, like how could I not have seen this?
Yeah, I mean, the best thing that did for me was it gave me a sense of purpose. I understood why I was here, and for an Indigenous person, that's really key because I mean, suicide rates in Indian country are the highest anywhere in the world. And I think a lot of that has to do with not understanding one's purpose and innovating and making the first new bird songs in 150 years. I was like, I'm here for a reason. I feel like, any semblance of self-destructive behaviors I had kind of flew out of me with that understanding. I was like, no, I have to be here for a long time. I have to preserve this and I have to keep making this work in the world.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it feels good.
So, okay. So you were raised on the reservation?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
From, I mean, the whole childhood?
Mm-hmm. Until I left for college when I was 18. But yeah, and my dad is a tribal chairman and my mother was like, did the choir. They were both in the volunteer fire service. I mean, they were very community minded. Like I grew up understanding the benefit of and the value of community. And I think that's why wherever I go, community is very important to me. I mean, not that it's not important to other people, but it's like I can't help but build community. I feel like I understood the importance of having like, I don't know, I want to say something very basic, like-minded social networks, but something a little bit that there's something almost spiritually satisfying about having a community in that way.
I think it's essential, and I think it's a lost art, like creating community and understanding its value. I think a lot of people, especially, I don't know, I don't want to characterize it as like a predominantly urban thing, but it feels like so many people feel isolated or lonely or detached from any sense of real community. That's certainly the case in Los Angeles based on conversations I have. So I think people who have the gift of being able to create community are very necessary.
But it's like, I started an art collective when I was in Brooklyn in like 2007. I started like this podcast, Food for Thought, with some people and in making like Poets of Attitude, the reading series, and in just like, and in publishing and in reading. And I just kind of, I've always been able to kind of accumulate people around me or around the nucleus of an idea, but not in any kind of, almost self-determined way. It just happens. It's not accidental, but it definitely doesn't feel like I'm doing it with that intention. But it just kind of happens to grow around me.
Well, but you're willing to start things.
Yeah, absolutely.
People are hungry for it. Mm. You know, if somebody like sends up a flag, just takes that action, which is, I think, a hard action to take.
It's because starting it and maintaining it there are so... All aspects of it are difficult. I haven't found, one of my skills is I am able to commit to ideas and able to commit to action in a way that I've never been able to commit to a romantic partner. but it's working out for me so far.
Yeah. And so, I want to go back just before we get any further into like your creative life or your artistic life, is to talk more about your upbringing, because it's fascinating to me.
Right.
What is it like to grow up on a reservation? Like, I'm picturing, and this is in Southern California?
Yeah.
So I'm picturing, like, is it relatively, like, suburban?
No, it's rural.
It's rural.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like, when you say there's, like, a sense of community, like, what does it actually physically look like? What does the experience feel like?
Well, I mean, I obviously can't speak for Indian country in general, and I can't speak for other nations, and I can't speak for other reservations in San Diego. I can only speak from my experience on the Viejas Reservation of the Kumeyaay Nation. And what does it look like? I mean, asking anybody to describe their childhood is a little odd, because it's just so natural for any one person, you know. But it's... in the cut, in the middle of nowhere. When I grew up, it was dirt roads and dirt poor. Our fortunes changed a little bit over the course of my upbringing, but...
Why is that?
Well, my tribe got a casino. And so then that's why I was able to go to college. But there was a lot of... But that doesn't mitigate the effects of trauma. and in a lot of ways, it was... A place of limitless love. And in a lot of other ways, it was kind of a place that could really swallow you in grief if you let it. So that's difficult to process, I think, as a child, and to also have this sense of tragedy and also this incredible sense of comedy. Like my sense of humor was fermented in that place as much as my eye for my eye for trauma, you know? And so it explains me. You know, I feel like any way in which I act in the world that might seem disingenuous or scattered or whatever, it's a reflection of the place that I came from.
And I read that your mother, didn't your mother run, was it a pawn shop or a junk shop?
A thrift shop.
A thrift shop.
Yeah.
And that informed your book, or Junk.
Junk, yeah. I mean, I I was reading Garbage by A.R. Ammons, and I was also reading The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up by Marie Kondo.
Right.
And
now a hit television show.
Netflix television show. And I, you know, I was raised around junk, and I was raised around understanding the value that of things that other people discarded and to imbuing new life into objects. And I just, I mean, maybe all children do this, but I was very prone to giving objects personalities. And so it was hard for me to think of things being discarded. And I kind of became a little bit of a pack rat as a child.
Are you still?
No, I actually live like, I mean, this is the trauma of living in New York for 15 years. But like when you have to move apartments every fucking year, you really learn how to let go of things.
if it doesn't spark joy, it's out.
If it doesn't spark joy, if it's too heavy. Right. For a while there, I feel like I was moving so often that I would never put like art on the wall or paint anything or really do anything that would give an apartment a sense of roots or having like with the expectation that I was going to live there the next year, because like landlords are so shady. And it's like the amount of times that in 1 year somebody's been like, raise them at $500 and to a point that I can't live there anymore and then price me further out. It was just like so frustrating. I never understood. One of the things I understood about the freedom of New York was also that like that freedom was contingent on you always being uncomfortable and like never feeling like I never felt like I could set down there. So I think in a way it informed my work because the restlessness of long poems, I think, and their curiosity and their inability to like land in one place and their nature as like a dynamic flowing object was really informed by New York and like moving around so much.
You were literally moving pretty much every year?
Yeah. Sometimes I would be in a place for 3 years. Sometimes I'd be in a place for a little bit longer than that. But, it was just like it changed a lot between 2006 when I first moved to Brooklyn and then, you know, 2016. I mean, the amount of change that happened in the neighborhoods that I lived in was really astonishing.
Yeah. Well, how did you get to New York? You were on the reservation and then you said you were able to go to college because of the casino.
Yeah. I went to Sarah Lawrence in Westchester. It's a little bit further up from the city. It's like a 30-minute Metro North ride. And I would come into the city on the weekends and then eventually just kind of move. I mean, the thing is, I didn't really think I was going to stay in New York. I thought I would move back home. And then I realized that I could. Well, I had wanted to move back home because I thought, like, nobody I knew ever left. Nobody I knew ever stayed gone. So there wasn't really a model for me. I just figured after the 4 years I would move back home.
How did you even wind up at Sarah Lawrence?
Well, I had been writing poetry, and so I wanted to go. I heard it was a really good school for writing. And then one of my best friends had gotten a brochure from Sarah Lawrence, and that was one of the places that she was planning to go. But then after we graduated, she didn't end up going to college, and I just kind of, like, went. And I'd always, I mean, since I was a child, I'd wanted to live in New York. Like, my sister was on Broadway in like 95. She was not raised in our house. My mother had given her up for adoption when she was born. But when she got back in contact with our family, she was on Broadway. And we went to go visit her, and that was like fifth grade. And I remember surfacing from like the subway onto the street and just being like, I found a place that is as restless as I am. I had always like sat on my porch on the reservation and just kind of like, I'd like look towards like the light pollution of San Diego and just wanting to be there so bad, like wanting to be in the city, wanting to be in a place where things changed and wanting to be in a place where things were like louder or they were like the idea of like living in an apartment and not knowing the person on the other side of the wall was fascinating to me.
Right.
You know what I mean? Cause like we didn't have neighbors. You had people down the drive. It was very isolated place to be. And when I kind of fell in love with New York the first time I went there, because it was the answer to the thing that I was looking for, which was like in a weird way, it offers you a lot of exposure and anonymity at the same time.
Right.
Because, and also it's like people have their own business to mine, so they don't really care that much about yours. Whereas the place that I'm from, everyone is in everybody's business all the time. There's like no, there's no privacy. And so the idea of like being in a place where that was like abundant and private at the same time was fascinating to me. And
so you were in fifth grade when you first went?
Yeah.
And your sister, who your mom gave up for adoption, was how old when she was on Broadway?
I guess she was maybe in her 20s.
Oh, okay.
Early
so she wasn't
30s.
Like a child star.
No. My mother spaced out her kids by 10, 11, 12 years. So
okay,
it's
okay.
Me, my brother, and my sister. And we are, my brother was like a caregiver when I was a child because he was so much older than I was.
So you're the baby.
I'm the baby.
Okay.
Yeah. I feel like the decision to like be in New York in a way that like the decision to write long poems, it just kind of felt like something clicked and it made sense. And I was like, this is the place I need to be.
So you have like a sense of, it seems like you have an attuned sense of knowing when something's right for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so many things seem so wrong all the time that when something seems right, it's like, I want this. I'm going to like dig my chompers into this thing.
That's good intuition.
Yeah, I guess that is intuition. I just wish like the romantic thing would happen. That would be nice. I've never really met anybody where I was like, that felt in the same way. Like, oh, this is the thing.
But it just takes one.
Yeah.
You're still young, right?
Yes. I'm young for my age.
Me too. I'm 43. I don't feel like a day older than like 30, maybe.
Yeah. I'm 35. I feel like I've always kind of been 23.
There you go.
I was 23 when I was 5 years old. I was 23 when I was 18. I'm 23 at 35.
That's a good age.
Yeah, that's fine.
why leave 23?
Well, the thing is, like when I was younger, I was precocious, and now I'm immature because
right.
I've kind of stayed the same age.
And now, when it comes to like relationships and stuff like that, like are you using apps? Like, is that that's what you have to do these days?
Yeah,
right?
A little bit. This Los Angeles is not. Does not want to eat what I'm cooking. I'll tell you that much. It was relatively easy for me to at least hook up with people in New York. Los Angeles, I don't know. This place just isn't.
It's not an easy town to date in, I don't think.
And I don't. This is going to sound like stereotypical or whatever, but I found this to be a city of extraordinary flakes. Just people who will not commit to anything.
Right.
Like making plans and then breaking plans. That's just, it seems like I don't, for every five plans that I make with somebody, one of them actually comes to fruition.
It drives me crazy.
For the most part, people just don't really stick to their word.
If I say I'm going to do something, it is extremely rare that I don't do it.
Yeah, I felt that way. And the longer that I'm here, the more the tendency to flake, I really feel it in my bones. And I'm just like hoping that other person says that they want to stay in so I can stay in and watch, you know, Great British Bake Off or whatever.
Oh, I have other, but no, you mean you like when people flake?
A little bit, yeah.
I was going to say, because I have friends who like, that's their favorite thing. Like plans stress them out. And so when a social agreement is like impending, they get anxiety.
Mm-mm.
And their favorite thing is when the person's like, by the way, I have to flake. And then it's like, oh, thank God, I don't have to.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think quitting things is fun. I love playing hooky, you know, things like that. I love quitting classes and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, in terms of like romance or whatever and apps and dating and all that kind of stuff, it's never really been my priority. So
what is your priority?
Writing is my priority.
I was going to say, you don't quit on writing.
No.
You stick to a project. You seem committed.
Yeah.
Wouldn't do this interview until after you'd had your writing time in the morning.
That's correct. Yep.
And by the way, you have an assistant?
It's gotten to the point where it is impossible for me. What started to happen was I couldn't respond to emails fast enough. Like they would accumulate faster than I could respond to them.
You're getting that many emails?
I would miss out on opportunities. Like I told you, like my bread and butter is doing these college things, right?
Right.
And it got to the point where like I couldn't keep up with them, and then I would forget that I made one, or like that I was leaving on a Wednesday, or you know what I mean? Just because like there was so much stuff, and it's not just like so. There's like this whole aspect of like being a professional writer, which is like this performance thing. I'm good at that. I'm fine with that. I'll do that. I'll be on the road. I'll be in one place. I'll be in St. Louis on a Wednesday, and I'll be in Vancouver, Canada on a Thursday, and then I'll be in San Francisco on a Friday. You know what I mean? That's fine. I get it. It can be grueling, but like I said, it subsidizes my writing life. But that's just one aspect of it. And then there's like the actual writing part, which is like, I have to do that every day in order to get these opportunities. And then there's also like the wanting to be social part of life. And then there's like the wanting to date part of life. And then there's like the other writing opportunities that I have. And then there's like, so there's like the poetry one. And there's like the features writing one. And then there's this like nonfiction essay sort of thing in the clouds. And then there's like friends, and then there's, you know, and it like the email part of life was like sucking up way too much of it. And I had, and I've been able to make a living more or less like on writing. And so I was able to just kind of hire someone part-time to take care of like the submission, like getting asked to submit places. So like the writing opportunities part of it, the helping me book the tour sort of part of it, and then like the interview sort of part of it too, like this.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
It's hard to find balance.
I would like to know balance at some point in my life.
I think everybody would.
I would like it. I don't know. Maybe I need to get some kind of guru situation in my life.
Have you ever had one?
The closest thing I've had was a mentor.
You ever have a therapist or anything that helped
you?
Oh
my God. My therapist, Dr. John, is like my lifeline. Like I could not have been the person I am now if I didn't have Dr. John in my life.
I was going to say, you seem pretty well adjusted and like somebody who's done the work.
Yeah. And having somebody, I don't know. I feel like I've like in the sort of intuition thing, I've always kind of known who to listen to as well and learned how to hear. The thing is, people are talking at you all the time. Advice is coming through your life, whatever. And sometimes I don't hear it, but I feel like I'm really good at getting myself in the space to be able to hear what somebody is telling me, and able to like really incorporate that. But the thing is, it requires a lot of failure too. Like I've failed so much with Dr. John, but every single one thing that worked, I was able to build on that one thing that worked.
What do you mean failed? Like you tried certain behaviors or you tried to experiment socially in certain ways and it just didn't work out, or like,
yeah, I mean, getting on stage, bombing, you know, I bomb way more than I'm great, but I've gotten to the point where I'm cool with it. Or like my ratio of bombing to like good performances has decreased. So like I bomb a lot less, but especially in the beginning, I couldn't get a good performance. You know what I mean? I had to do that in front of people. I couldn't do that on my own. I couldn't do that abstractly. I couldn't do that in my mind. That had to be stuff I did in front of people. And that was hard. And so like that's a part of it. The dating part of it, the putting yourself out there part of it, the asking people out part of it. That's like rife with failure. Also just like, figuring out like how to be a person in the world. I feel like there's a lot of ways in which like I've tried different, you know, like trying to like going out to different places and being like, that's not my place, and figuring out what my places were. Like that was a lot of trial and error too.
You mean like which bars or which like
literally and metaphorically? Yeah. You know, what part of the day is best for me to write? You know what I mean? Like, what should I do? And little things like, what are my favorite movies? What are the things that I like? Because like for the most part in my 20s, all I did was date people, and I really submerged my personality into theirs. So what they liked became what I liked. You know what I mean? Like their favorite color was my favorite color. Their favorite band was my favorite band. Their favorite movie was my favorite movie. And I kind of like the thing that I did that really kind of kickstarted my writing, I guess, was that I took a year off from dating after a particularly demoralizing breakup. And I was like, I'm doing the same thing and expecting a different result, which is just, I'm expecting men to do for me what I can't, or I'm unwilling to do for myself, which is like accept myself or like listen to myself.
And or it's like pick your own favorite color.
Yeah, exactly. And so I remember sitting on, and I've said this before in my podcast, but I remember sitting, after this breakup, I remember sitting on the East River and like looking out into the water and committing to date myself the way that I dated men, and to date writing the way that I dated men, which is to like fixate on it and do it all the time.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then what about Dr. John? Like when did he come into your life?
It's funny because I remember going to the first time I went to Dr. John, I had gotten a referral from a person I had seen while I was at Sarah Lawrence, and she had a friend in the city who was a therapist. And he's a gay therapist. His practice was on Gay Street for a little while in the West Village. And I was getting to, it was like my first boyfriend in Brooklyn. And he was kind of stepping out on me a little bit with one of my friends. And I could foresee the end of our relationship. And I was like, this is going to devastate me. I need to start talking to somebody. So I made an appointment with Dr. John to help me deal with my first breakup. And we kind of, that was 7, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9. That was like maybe 10 years ago. And our relationship, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that's a relationship to me. And we've been together for 10 years, and there have been times that we have not seen eye to eye on things. There have been times that we have argued with each other. And I've had to learn how to be with him as much as I've had to learn how to be with any other kind of man before.
How often do you talk to him?
Now it's a lot less because he's based in New York. So it's like when I go out there, we do phone things sometimes. I don't have as many pressing psychological concerns as I used to. One of the great advents of therapy in my life has been that I've kind of internalized Dr. John's voice. So I can ask him without him really having to be there.
Sure.
But, you know, I kind of check in like every 3 months or so.
Yeah.
But there's the thing is, like, anytime some kind of old issue is like remedied, some new one comes in, and it's usually a part of that old issue that's found a new face. So it's like this whole road loneliness thing. And I'll just like talk to him about that discord of being like, I've kind of quote unquote made it, and I'm still lonely. Like, what's that all about? You know, so little things like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, were you like, and you grew up in isolation or in some degree of isolation. I mean, especially to people who had like a more suburban or urban upbringing, like living on a reservation, kind of like you said, sitting on your porch, your neighbors are, they're there, but they're kind of down the road a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I guess like it's in some ways like kind of physical isolation, but in a very codependent environment. So that's that kind of... In a way, I think that probably informed my distaste of romantic relationships, because I was surrounded by people who are codependent, and I've done the opposite, which is like be super independent, which is not a remedy of codependency. Like, there's a way of being with somebody without being all into them, but I just kind of didn't have a model for that. So I didn't know how to do that, which is why when I took my year off from dating and I was like, I need to break with this pattern, like this whole pattern of throwing yourself into a relationship that seemed normal to me was like, no, this is bad.
like getting that intense,
mm-hmm.
like that quick, like, were you one of these people who was like 0 to 60?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think now that my self-esteem comes from what I make and do in the world, I'm more in control of that.
Yeah. Well, what about like as a young person, like being gay on a reservation, like dating on a reservation, going to school on a reservation, like how big of a community was it?
Well,
like,
I didn't go to school on the res. There was an elementary school in the next town over that I went to, and then later on further out to a high school. It's just very remote. And I didn't really, I mean, I dated off, like, you know, I'd go to punk shows as a teenager, and I'd kind of meet boys there. The community is really small. It's like 300 people. There are more reservations in San Diego County than in any other county in the United States, but they're all very, very small. There used to be a much larger one that the county, that San Diego, as the city got bigger and needed water, and you know, there was water flowing through our res, and like they broke it. It's just a tale as old as time. It's like basically indigenous extermination.
Right.
We had our own little trail of tears. The community itself, again, like being gay on the res wasn't a problem for me.
When did you come out?
I came out when I was like 15, maybe. I didn't experience homophobia from people on the reservation. I experienced homophobia from people outside the reservation. I experienced homophobia in school. Like, I didn't experience homophobia at home.
Because San Diego's kind of a conservative town.
Yeah, and especially East County, where I was living. You know, you would see neo-Nazi and KKK people out there. Like, it was anybody who's surprised by the current administration and political thing, I knew that was coming. I grew up around those people. I knew who they were. I went to school with them. Like, I fought with them on the bus. You know what I mean? Like, they don't surprise me.
Yeah. Do you think you have hope? Like, do you think that there's a possibility that we're going to come out of this and somehow rejuvenate or repair or be better?
Not if the answer is continued late-stage capitalism and heteropatriarchy. Like, there is something that needs to fundamentally change about the system. I think in a lot of ways, and this is something that I read on Morgan Parker's Twitter page. I think it's pinned to the top of her page if you want to check it, at Morgan Apple on Twitter. That America was a really bad idea. And I think America was a really bad idea because it's contingent upon the subjugation and extermination of indigenous people and black slavery and labor. And any idea that America is an exceptional country is a fabrication in order to cover up the fact that it was able to be a major economic power because of those two things.
Yeah, I think like the America's self-perception or the perception of America that we're often fed by the political class, you know, there are virtues to America, but I feel like the presentation of them is ballooned out of proportion to these like fundamental sins.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what you're going to do. You can't, like, what are we going to do? Like, just everybody, like, leave and go back to Europe? Or, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's here. America's a thing. Like, how do we possibly address the karma of this country? Like, the best idea that I've heard is the idea of reparations.
Mm-hmm.
Like, serious reparations. Reparations that try to make it right and try to, like, make formalized an apology and an acknowledgement of wrongdoing.
Yeah, I mean, at least. You
right?
know what I mean? Like, it's a system and an oppressiveness and a subjugation that is not really examined and oftentimes denied. I mean, if you look at like what's going on in sort of like the right sort of propaganda wing, it's a complete denial that anything ever happened. And if the system continues to deny its part in genocide and subjugation and all the and oppression and all that kind of stuff, there can't be a remedy. But I'm just trying to write. You know what I mean? I'm just trying to live here day to day. I'm trying to get up because it's hard enough to write. You know what I mean? It's hard enough to do that every day. It is the worst job in America. I mean, there are worse jobs, obviously. But it is very difficult because you can do anything but it. And I think – and it just – it's a – there – when nobody ever told me that all parts of this job are horrible. It's like the making of the thing and it just – it's like – fecal essence that just you feel like it attaches to you and it follows you wherever you go. Everything is bad. Everything, like every draft is a shitty draft. Like nothing is ever finished or perfect or done. You just have to say I'm done. I'm ready to move on to the next thing. That's why when people like that made me kinder to books because I'm just willing to give it up if anybody finishes anything. And when people talk like with people being critical of people's work, I understand that. But it's like, I know what happened. You were like, I can't do this anymore. Like when people are like, oh, this is an inconsistency with this part of the book. And I don't like the way that this ended. And it's like, they were just done. They were really just done with it. Like, it's not a failure of the writer. I don't think necessarily. It's more just like the recognition that other things must be done.
Yeah. Well, and I'm right there with you. Like anybody who finishes a book, regardless of its publication status or the success that it has in the marketplace, once you've gone through the process of trying to write one of these things, unless you're one of these rare creatures who like it's a joy, you know.
I know one person like that and I actively resent him. Hello, Joseph Osmondson, I hate you. He likes it. I'm like, you are masochist. Like I understand the feeling of being satisfied. You know what I mean? I understand the feeling of being proud of something, or at least to get other, because I'm very osmotic with feeling. So it's like if somebody's feeling something around me, it's easy that I catch that feeling. And if somebody is like enjoys it, I sort of enjoy their enjoyment. You know what I mean? But I've never felt like, well, I'm writing that this is great or I'm having a great time. It's more like this is less hurtful than the last time. Maybe this is like less painful,
slightly less painful.
Yeah. It's like the thing that I'm working on now, within the past few days, I've understood things about the work. And it, again, it's like a screenplay. And so it's like entering into this world of sort of narrative fiction that I never asked to do. I didn't know. Like, somebody was like, I'll give you this money if you make this thing. And I was like, sure, I'll do it. No problem. But it has confounded me, and plot confounds me in a way that, I mean, I write long poems. It's not above the pale that I have narrative, that I have, that I invite narrative into my work. You know what I mean? In ways that maybe some poems don't always do. But plot, and it's just so sad. Because you make these characters, and then you you identify what they want, and you identify what they're most afraid of, and you scare them with the thing that they're most afraid of, and you make it hard as hell for them to get what they want, and then you just like watch them bang their head against a wall, and it's like, should I do this to this person? Like, in order to make dramatic things happen, which is, it's a medium of drama. People have to have secrets from each other. People have to get in fights with each other. People have to hate each other. People have to not want what's best. And I'm out here trying to live my life, like, generously. And I have to write people who are dicks. Yeah. And that's a little bit of a mind fuck.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. There's something about, like, really heavy, like heavy plotting. I struggle with it, too. I don't know. I don't want to use the word artificial, but that's probably not right. That's not the right attitude.
I have to Google, like, what do people do? Like, people have, like, they go on whale watching things. They have book clubs or something. Or, like, they have, like, careers. Like, what do people do? I don't know, because I don't do – all I do is write.
Yeah.
So it's, like, I have to be, like, and, like, and the thing that I'm writing, like I said, like, I've figured out more of the plot and more of the I wouldn't say that I enjoy it, but it there's, like, a – like, you know, after you take a shot and you have like that tingling in your ears, it's like kind of hot.
You mean like a shot of alcohol?
Yeah. Like, that's kind of what it feels like. Like, there's like some kind of feeling of being under the influence that that when it's really doing its, when the work is doing its job and when I'm doing my job, I sort of feel, which is, I think, why later on when I'm presented with my work, I'm like, did I do that?
Right.
I did that, didn't I? But yeah. I don't know where it came from. I don't know. But I'm not one of these people who's like into inspiration or the muse or whatever. I'm into hard work. But still, I'll look at it and I can't deny that there is something divine about creation. You know what I mean? And then like looking at it and being like, I don't remember doing that, but I guess I did. I mean, I'm taking credit for it because I'm cashing this check, but like, I don't, who did that? Right. I guess it was me.
You were like the channel.
Yeah.
You're channeling it. But I also feel like if you're working in a narrative vein and you're playing puppet master or whatever, on the days where things are going well, the sense of loneliness that tends to plague writers is less.
Yeah.
It's less lonely on those days.
Yeah. And especially like if you're lucky enough to actually have an audience, or you're lucky enough to have a publisher, or you're lucky enough to have an editor or whatever, there is the faith that somebody is going to read it at some point, even if you never know. So that is like kind of what I'm also writing about in Feed, which is like this sort of message in a bottle, the feeling of writing and understanding that like other people get fed by, it was like this Molly Shannon movie called Year of the Dog, I think it was, or yeah, she like yeah, plays yeah. a crazy dog lady, quote unquote. And she's just like, she has this monologue at the end where she's like, you know, some people, their love is like, love is all around us. And it takes so many different forms. There's like love and partnership, you know, boyfriend or girlfriend, husband, wife, whatever. There's like love of children. There's love of material things. And just like her love of dogs is the thing that feeds her. And similarly, I had to be like, this thing of writing, this advent, or this thing of writing is the thing that feeds me. It's different love than other love. You know, I don't know. Okay. I'm going to say this and I will go back on this at some point in the future, probably, but I don't know that a person could really, I don't know. I'm just saying, cause it's never happened before. I don't know that I could find fulfillment in a partner the way I find fulfillment in writing, you know? And I don't know if I could be fed by a romantic partner the way that I get fed by writing.
I can't say that's not true. I feel like I have friends whose books are their children, and who kind of feel a sense of like paternal or maternal love or connection to their creative work. And I get that.
Well, it is your legacy. in the way that children are your legacy, you right. know, and that they will live on after you. If, you know, if it's not like Fahrenheit 451 or whatever, but like, but the thing though, the really, really frustrating thing, is that with poems, more or less, you know, they say kill your darlings or whatever, but more or less, I've been able to save things. Like, more or less, I've been able to keep what I've written, refine it more, find more vigorous or better words or whatever. But, like, whatever idea I've had, I've kind of, like, I've sanded away until I made a beautiful object or I made a thing. With narrative fucking fiction writing in the way that I'm doing it now, like, I'll write and then just have to delete. And I'm like, but I had to delete. It'll be something like where I have these two people waking up in bed together and then they have a whole conversation and they have a whole day. And then I realize, no, actually that person has to leave before the other one gets up. And then like fucking 15 pages of shit is just down the drain. And I have less words and pages than I had the day before. And that infuriates me. And I don't know any other way, because I do this outline thing. I write these, I do these like proposed skeletal structures, but nothing is, I don't know anything until I write it out. And then now, and then this character's gone. And then that character's gone. And there's like this new person. And like, where did you all come from? So I don't know. Do you have any advice?
I think that's the nature of it. I feel like, I mean, if you're talking about screenwriting, which is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, I think like you have some kind of outline going in typically because it's a defined form, and then you deviate from it.
Yeah.
That's normal.
It sucks.
But it's demoralizing.
It's really demoralizing.
To lose pages and to lose character and just to realize you're on the wrong track. You're like, oh, fuck.
And to know that you're on the wrong track while you're doing it, but you have to do it in order to figure out what the right track is.
Yeah.
That is the hardest part, because it's like you're pumping sewage into your computer. Like, it's coming out of your fingers. And like, again, I could do anything else. Like, I could be playing Candy Crush Friends right now. Or I could be on the phone with my best friend. Nope, I've got to sit here and write this shit, like right. this absolute fecal matter, and then like print it out, go over it with a red pen, figure out what the right thing is, and do it all over again, and then like 5 days later delete that whole section. It's just like, I don't.
How did you get into screenwriting?
I was commissioned by a production company in New York called CineReach.
How did that happen?
They liked my books. And the guy, this guy Mike, who was a part of the company, who'd kind of been like a little, like a fixture in my life to a certain extent, in the sense that I knew him as like Mike from Around. Like, you know, that person from Around that you see them at that one party, or there was this party called Queers, Beers, and Rears in the Lower East Side in New York. And they would have a few punk bands come in every month. And I didn't know that, because I moved to New York and then that was there. I didn't know that that could be taken away. Like, I didn't know how special it was. But I would go every month and they would have three queer punk bands every single month. And I would see him at that. He was like, you know, those in the nebulous way that you know people, that it's like that the high school best friend of my roommate's freshman year college roommate, you
right.
know, something like nebulous like that. But it always kind of seemed around. And I remember one time, it was like when I was in Astoria. I had an office space in Astoria when I was writing. I was finishing up Nature Poem, I think, and I probably put something on Facebook like, I'm in Astoria, like da da da, or no, it was Long Island City. And Mike got in touch and was like, oh, do you want me to take you out to like a bar around here, like a cafe? Do you want to get to know the neighborhood? And so we went out and he was like, so how's poetry doing? And I was like, and again, this is like midway through edits of my second book. And I was like, you know, it's like great or whatever. I'm like, great. I'm glad I found my thing. I'm glad I found my medicine. But like, there is no money in this.
It's
if
hard.
Somebody gave me X amount of thousands and thousands of dollars and was like, go write this thing, I would go write that thing. Like, I can't sell out fast enough. Are you kidding me? I want, get me on a Coke commercial. I will write fucking slogans for Pepsi. I don't know. Just, I want to make money and I have this talent and I need to do this thing. And about a year later, I was on a beach with an ex-boyfriend and we had been joking about peeing on each other because there was jellyfishes in the water. And I was I hope you're okay with me peeing on you. And he was like, And I learned that day that he really liked to get peed on. So like that started a new advent of my relationship with him. I got a call from this Mike from Around. And he was like, I want to talk to you about an opportunity. Will you come into my office? It's like on Fifth Avenue. And I was like, sure. And my therapist is on Fifth Avenue. So I was thinking of it like an office like that, like a cubicle.
Yeah.
So I go there. I open the door, and this office is just, it takes up so much of this floor of this building. And
one
then
office?
There's like, it's just one office. And it's like, there's like a meeting room in the center and a spiral staircase that leads up to a second floor that has like a viewing room. And there's like all of these other cubicles around. And it was just him and like one of the other people that works there. And I was like, oh shit. And I was like looking at all the posters around and I was like, oh, you made all these aren't decoration. You made all these movies. And the thing about living in New York or anywhere else is like everyone is doing something. Everyone is a musician or everyone is a writer. Or everyone is an actor. Everyone does move. But like you hear that so often that it kind of becomes like white noise because they're like, but what have you done lately?
Right.
You know what I mean? Or are you an actor or are you a waiter? You know what I mean? Like, so I knew that he had done something in movies, but I just, everyone's doing something. And I was like, oh, shit. And he had, like, co-founded this company. And I was like, and he was like, you know, remember last year when you said, if somebody gave me all this money to write this thing, I would write this thing. He was like, would you write this thing? And I was like, inside, I was, like, dying. I was screaming because I didn't know what I was getting myself into. I was like, but then I saw the amount, and I was like, you know what? Absolutely. And it will be on time. And
yeah.
I made more money in the course of my 7-month contract with them than I had made in 15 years of writing poetry, like
sure.
significantly more. And I was like, you know what? And I took to the medium in the sense that like I found the structure really comforting because before writing features, I had just kind of seen them as like these magical things that come out of nowhere. And I'd never watched or read for, I'd always watched and read for escape and never to understand what was going on. And once I learned the 3-act structure and this happens on page 5 and this happens on page 25 and this happens on page 55, just reading,
reading scripts or reading books about screenwriting,
both. And like the thing that they suggested that I do that was extremely helpful was like read the thing, watch the thing, and then read the thing again to see how they translate each other.
Huh.
So it was like reading books about screenwriting,
talking to
screenwriters. The one cat one,
Save the Cat.
Save the Cat. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one. Like, it's practical.
Yeah, and I don't agree with everything in that book. I mean, but it's like this is how you write a commercial film. And I was like, all right, that's a way to write a commercial film, and I agreed with a lot of it. And I think there are ways in which, you can complicate it as well. But I needed to learn the basic thing before I could even hope to play with the medium at all.
Right.
Like, I'm a formalist. Like, I started writing poetry by doing, like, I learned how to do sestinas. I learned how to do sonnets. I learned how to do villanelles. I learned how to do, high buns and pantoums and all that kind. Those were the first poems that I ever wrote. And I wrote those until I could do them in my sleep. They weren't very interesting, but I knew what I was working with. So when I do these long poems and this free verse and stuff, it's with a deep understanding of poetic structure. And similarly, like, I had to learn, my first couple of months trying to do this, I was out of my brain because I was like, I don't know what I'm writing about. I don't know what I'm doing. And then I had fiction friends of mine be like, well, your character has to have a desire and you have to make it really hard for them to get that thing. And they're like, and if they're content in this part, then they have to be fucked up in this part. It was like kind of mapping out what it is that plot does. And it's artifice, right? So it's like, it's artifice, but it's also ancient and it's foundational and it's everywhere you read. And so I started to read with an eye for what was happening. And I started watching with like my hand on the timestamp,
right?
Being like, oh, yep, 5 minutes in, that's what happens. So this
the
person
inciting
says
incident.
That. Yep, exactly. I'm like, this is the world turned upside down and this is like the midpoint and this is like, okay, and this is where they reference death. And it's like, it all became so transparent to me.
Isn't it weird how we do it? Like, I mean, it's easy to like poo-poo the conventions of commercial storytelling,
mm-hmm.
but we have these expectations of what a narrative is supposed to do,
and it's actually extremely difficult. But I mean, okay, it's not the hardest thing I've ever done, but doing something, innovating on a convention. Like, it's so hard. So that's, I think a lot of people end up just burning it all down and being like, I'm going to do this weird other thing. But I actually want to write commercial film. I want to write conventional commercial films, but with characters who I understand and I identify with. Characters who are queer, maybe non-binary, native especially, you know, but like, and within that, what would a conventional story be like? And that...
Is that what you were hired to write? Or was it like an...
I must have done something good in a past life because all of my... my publishing experiences and my feature experiences, like, they've all been great. I hear a lot of horror stories, and thankfully I haven't had one. But they were just kind of like, here's this check and do whatever you want. But that was actually extremely hard because they didn't hire me for a project. They were just like, we want to know what film you would make. And I had to learn what movies actually were. And that learning curve was so steep.
Yeah, but it's good. You just get thrown into the fire.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you have a certain amount of work ethic and ambition and willingness to kind of roll your sleeves up, you're going to learn it.
And I learned, I think, I don't know if I learned anything necessarily, but I think what I learned is how to ask the right questions. Like, I just wish I knew, obviously, like, I wish I knew now a year ago, you know, or it just, there's so much time I feel like I wasted in order to figure out very basic things like that so much base was like revelation to me, bothers me, but I don't know how I would have learned it any other way.
Well, and so where are you now? How many features have you written?
Well, I'm working on one with a producer out here. I have a writing partner in Seattle who I'm working on a couple of scripts with. I have a writing partner in San Francisco who are working on an idea right now. Honestly, like the first one that I wrote, I had to write on my own. And I feel like what I did in 7 months, I was able to do in like 17 minutes with a writing partner.
I'm the same way. Why is screenwriting... Because like poetry, it's not normal to work in tandem with somebody.
No.
But working with a partner on a screenplay is like so much better.
It's so much better. I don't ever want to... I want to write movies with everybody. You know what I mean? Like I figured out the thing that I want to do for the next good chunk of my life. And I love working with other people because there is just so much more. Like my problem with this project I'm working on now is I'm the only one. So I'm like Googling, what do people do? But when I'm in the room with somebody and we're like, all right, look, let's talk about, all right, so this pop star has a body double, right? And the body double, it's like an All About Eve situation. The body double doesn't want to give up the spotlight after the tour is over. So like, let's talk about then who is she? And then where does she come from? And like, what's her Wikipedia page? You know what I mean? And so it's like getting to understand another, and also having this, and I think this came from like doing improv for a minute, this sort of yes anding and like working on ideas with somebody and trying to create an environment where any suggestion is fine and it just like might change later on, that really helped. And just like having the people that I've worked with are curious in a way that I'm curious, I think, and it never feels like weird or bullying or like your ideas are getting shot down. It's just like, okay, but if this person is this way, do you think this is blah, 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 blah? And then, like, getting to a point, and I did, like, my friend from Seattle came down, like, a couple weeks ago. We were, like, workshopping these two things. And I was like, I don't think they have a kid. I think all that work we did to make them have a kid is just, like, counterintuitive. And it's, like, eating up a lot of our resources. And what happens if the kid goes?
Plus, it's, like, a pain in the ass to direct children.
Perhaps. but, yeah, I just feel like I work through ideas faster. And I get to... what I lack in understanding plot, they have. I'm so much better at just writing every single day. And I'm really good with dialogue. and so it's like the way that we work it out, or the way that I've worked out with them is, you know, we come up with the idea, we do the treatment, then I do the shitty rough draft. And then we get together, we talk it over, then they go off and do another draft. I work on something else. And then like we come back together and like I do like the final passover and like, you know, we'll do the... And just make sure the dialogue is what it's supposed to be.
It's so much faster.
It's
like we have double the brain power.
Yeah. And then the thing is that like some ideas work with some people and some ideas work with other people. So I just, again, like, and I have like, so I have those things in the, those irons in the fire or whatever, but then I also just have like five other ideas for things that like when those are done, I can go work on. Like my horror movie that I want to write, like I want to have the, my romantic comedy that I want to write, you know what I mean? I want to do Indians in Space, you know what I mean? So it's like, I have ideas that I just need to be able to sit with for a while, but I love it because I don't have any kind of, when I finish a project, I don't have any kind of, for lack of a better word, like postpartum. You know what I mean? It's like, because I'm always kind of working on something new. So it's like, and also it helps me not be such a control freak with any one given project, because it's like I'm viewing it in a sea of other projects that I'm working on. And so like I get less precious with ideas and with characters and with things. And so I'm more amenable to people's suggestions, and it's made me better as a writer and better getting edited as well.
You don't seem to have any shortage of ideas.
No, I don't think so.
So that part of it's easy.
Yeah.
Like you're generative.
Yeah. Or it's easy for me to generate ideas with people as well. Mm-hmm. Even if we sit there and we haven't done any work yet, and it's like, okay, so generally, what is it that you're interested in? Okay, relationships between fathers and sons. All right, let's take a look at that. Now, let's talk about some things that could potentially invert this relationship. So a parent gets older, or a child gets rich, or, you know, like ways in which we can challenge. So understanding the conventions, how we challenge the conventions. And then I figure out what interests me about that. And it's just... it's just so much better than working on my own.
It's fun to ideate in conversation.
Yeah.
Like just talking to somebody.
Yeah.
Like that, like sitting at a cafe, mm-hmm. coming up with ideas rather than just kind of sitting there like staring at your keyboard or whatever.
Yeah. And just kind of trying to will it to happen and nothing's happening. And then I feel like it's a personal failing because I haven't figured out what the idea is. So I guess in a way that, you know, you're co-parenting or you're sharing ownership over something, or, you know, I don't feel like the burden of its shittiness, but I also get to share in its joy.
Right. Well, what is your actual, I mean, you write in the mornings? Do you have like a, really rigorous, like dedicated practice?
I do. In the morning, like the first things first, I just play 20 minutes of Candy Crush. I just have to give myself a thing to just like kind of dissociate, and then I'll read something. Depending on what I did the day before, either I've like tried to sort of think through some problems that I was having, or I need just some new idea. Like I need a new scene, or I need a new thing. Like I need a new character. Or I need them to do something different. Or I've kind of identified how people are pulling their weight in certain areas, and then just kind of refining that. So usually I'll do that like for a few hours until about noon, and then I'll take my walk. Usually I walk over to Larchmont, like get coffee or whatever. Actually, I don't drink coffee anymore, but like get like a tea and a scone or something, and just kind of like clear my head, and then kind of come back down and reengage with what it is that I'm doing, and then read a script or watch a movie.
What about poetry? Where does that fit?
I'm not working on, like, I just finished finished the final draft of my fourth book. So that is going to Blurbers right now. So it's like, I kind of put that to bed, and in my mind, and it might be my last thing. You know, I might be transitioning out of, it's funny because my editor was like, this is so much more narrative and it's so much more, there's so much more plot in this and there's like actual dialogue and characters. And he's like, I can see the transition between this and the next thing that you write. But you know, I came up as a poet, I'll die as a poet. I don't know when the next thing is going to be, but I mean, I wrote four books in 4 years. So I think I can like put that to bed for a little while.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Let the girls catch up and I can go work on these other things.
Well, it's such a pleasure to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
I appreciate you coming over. I congratulate you on all of the different successes that you're having, and I wish you well.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. That's Tommy Pico. His books include IRL, Nature Poem, Junk, and the forthcoming Feed. Be on the lookout. You can find him on the internet at tommy-pico.com. His Twitter handle is @HeyTeebs. Tommy Pico. Go get your copies. Just get the whole collection. Just buy all of them. Thanks to Kill Rock Stars and the band Stereo Total, as always, for the theme song music. Thank you to Tiger in My Tank for the interstitial music. Don't forget about the Other People app. It's free. Go get the Other People app. If you want to support this program, your support makes a difference. You can do that at patreon.com/otherpplpod. If you would like to write to me, the address is letters@otherppl.com. What am I forgetting? I think that's it. Right? I have a friend. I was talking to my friend this week about this like trend in the the lit community, like literary fiction and nonfiction, involving like gritty authenticity and like edginess. I'm not even going to get into it.